The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Kids, they grow up so fast, and girls, it turns out, are growing up even faster. As early as a generation ago, less than 5% of girls went through puberty before age 8. Now that percentage has doubled. To discuss the possible causes of early puberty and provide some practical advice for parents, we spoke with the authors of the book, The New Puberty, How to Navigate Early Development in Today's Girls. Dr. Juliana Deerdorf is a clinical psychologist on the faculty of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Dr. Louise Greenspan is a clinical pediatric endocrinologist and on faculty at UC San Francisco. We spoke to them when the book was first released. It's now out in paperback. Well, to clarify, when we talk about puberty in girls, what does that mean exactly?
What most people think of when they hear the word girl's puberty is first periods. And what people may not understand is that the process actually starts a lot earlier than that. And what we talk about with girls is the first sign of puberty being most commonly breast development, and it can be very subtle. And another common first sign would be pubic hair development.
Now, how early is early?
Well, we're seeing that girls are starting now commonly at age 7 and 8. So we were part of a large study that showed that at age 7, 15% of girls had breast development and 10% had pubic hair development. So it really is starting earlier than we used to think it started.
Well, you said it's not the same as starting their periods, but are girls who are experiencing puberty earlier also starting menses earlier?
Yeah, that's what's interesting, and part of why Louise and I got interested in studying this phenomenon. So girls are starting breast and pubic hair development earlier, but not necessarily menstruation or first period, which we call menarche.
So it looks like puberty might be taking longer.
To me, it sounds very early. Is it something to be concerned about?
Well, early puberty can have some negative downstream effects. So we know that the earlier you are when you have your first period, for example, before age 11 versus after age 14, the higher the risk of breast cancer later in your life. We also know that girls who have early pubertal development are more at risk for eating disorders, depression, earlier sexual activity, and heart disease, and in fact, all-cause mortality. But one thing we really want to make people understand is that those effects aren't necessarily bound to happen, and that parents can do a lot to modify those risks.
Well, let's talk. You've been studying this trend for quite a while, which you call the new puberty, title of your book, and your research points to three different causes, beginning with obesity. What have you found about the connection between early puberty and obesity?
Yeah, we outline in the book that a fat tissue is a very potent endocrine organ or a hormone-secreting organ. And the more fat tissue you have, the more estrogen is produced in your body. So the girls that are more overweight are going to have higher levels of estrogen, which could lead to earlier pubertal development.
And study after study has shown a correlation, a link between overweight and early development. So girls who have higher body weight tend to go through puberty earlier.
Could this be one of the explanations in why we're seeing puberty earlier in girls? I mean, as human beings develop, nutrition gets better, food gets better, but you're talking about obesity.
Yeah, we are. Although it may be along the spectrum that girls that are overweight are also at risk. We do think that this is a large cause of the earlier onset of puberty in girls, but we don't think it's the only cause. We do think that the other triggers or the other factors may be contributing.
Yeah, and it's actually a little different from kind of meeting the nutritional requirements for going through puberty. So there were certainly some large decreases in terms of the age at puberty as countries became more developed and nutrition was more available, or we moved away from situations of malnutrition, for sure. However, this obesity piece, it seems to be a different trajectory that girls are on.
Let's get to some of the other factors. Something that I've heard an awful lot about for, you know, at least the last decade is hormones in the environment. Are they a cause of early puberty?
Simplistically, no. Hormones are not necessarily a cause, but there may be chemicals that are in the environment or in the food that we eat that act like hormones in our body. They're called endocrine disrupting chemicals. So the concern is that exposure to these chemicals may lead to hormone-like actions in our bodies. The problem is that we don't know which chemicals are doing this, and we're all exposed to so many chemicals. So we do think this is a contributing factor, and we actually outline in the book ways to minimize one's exposure to those kinds of chemicals.
What are some of the hormone mimicking or endocrine influencing chemicals that you do identify?
So, again, the research is in its infancy, and we haven't isolated one particular chemical. But some of the ones that we're looking at in our studies are things like flame retardants, pesticides, classes of chemicals called phthalates or phenols. We're also concerned about even some naturally occurring compounds or chemicals, things like soy, lavender, tea tree oil.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about soy, certainly, and bovine growth hormone, for example. Anything conclusive on BGH?
No, there's nothing conclusive on the bovine growth hormone, but we do think that the growth hormone, any that is in any milk, is mostly broken down in the stomach, because even if you give humans human growth hormone, it is broken down in the stomach. That's why children who need, or adults who take it as a medicine, have to use it by injection. So we don't think that's a big culprit. We're more concerned, for example, about the antibiotics that those dairy cows may have been exposed to, because we don't think those are broken down in the stomach.
All right, another factor here, the last of your three causes stress among little girls. Now, what kind of stress, and why would that affect them this way?
So this is kind of a lesser known area of research that's been going on for a while. Now, while we think that stress isn't the primary culprit that would be pushing puberty earlier, because there's always been stress and there's always been issues of stress in families, we do know that girls who grow up in family environments that have low consistency, more instability, higher levels of conflict, and lower levels of warmth tend to go through puberty earlier. And that's been well documented for decades in the literature.
We're talking about some of the reasons why girls today are entering puberty so much earlier than a generation ago. I'm speaking with researchers Juliana Deerdorf and Louise Greenspan. They're co-authors of The New Puberty, How to Navigate Early Development in Today's Girls. Any of these three factors owe to cultural, socioeconomic differences?
Yeah, we actually recently published a big paper looking at socioeconomic status in the United States, and showed that indeed girls who have lower family incomes and certain markers of lower socioeconomic status tend to experience puberty earlier, at least in terms of getting their periods earlier. And there's a couple other studies that have also shown that. What's interesting is those socioeconomic differences also seem to account for some race and ethnicity differences that we see in timing of puberty in the United States.
And how far back do records go on this? When you're talking about doing research, is there anything that we know about when puberty was happening, say, you know, in the early 20th century or even earlier?
You know, not so much. So it's very tricky. The one thing that we can study at least reasonably well with data that is retrospective, looking back, recall, is onset of first period. So with some level of reliability, women can remember around when they got their first period. So we've been able to track that over generations, a couple generations. And those data are interesting in terms of menstruation. But for breast and pubic hair, the data are far less reliable and consistent. So we do have some data dating back to, you know, the mid 1900s, would you say, Louise? Yeah. Mm-hmm. However, in our studies that we've been doing more recently, we're doing a clinical examination of the girls. So we can actually palpate their breasts and know that breast tissue is not obesity, for instance. It's really hard to tease those two apart. So the rigor that's needed to know whether a girl is starting breast development early is actually quite high.
Could there be, an evolutionary reason for the pituitary gland kicking in and entering puberty at an earlier age? You know, any sort of advantage to it?
That's interesting. You know, we don't know a ton about the advantages. They haven't been as well studied. However, there is a whole body of work that's been done in evolutionary developmental psychology that says in homes where girls are growing up, where there is less consistency and perhaps more signals of danger, that girls go into puberty early because there's not a whole lot of reason to wait. And mm-hmm. if we're talking about reproduction as the ultimate marker of, you know, kind of success, from an evolutionary perspective at least.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's danger.
Right.
You should reproduce now. You
right.
don't know how long you'll be around. Any indication that this new puberty is happening in other countries?
So there is a wealth of literature coming out in other locations. For example, the Netherlands has studied, and they're showing a similar effect. And other research is also going on in places like Chile and other developed countries. It does look like it's an issue in the developed world.
It's hard to wrap one's head around. I mean, what is your best piece of advice for a parent? You know, how to start the conversation about puberty for girls and boys, too, when they seem so young?
Well, I think, you know, it's part of why we wrote this book. And to arm yourself with knowledge, I think, is the first step for parents. This can be very awkward for parents who haven't had experience talking about these kinds of changes. And, of course, a generation ago, people didn't really talk about this stuff with their kids. It just happened. So arming yourself with knowledge, getting the right kind of material so you know how to get started really helps. And also there's great books for kids as well out there.
How about for boys? Do they have to understand this change in girls as well?
We really advocate for teaching both gendered kids about what's going on. Boys are the peers of girls in almost all schools these days, and they need to understand what's happening with girls' bodies and also the appropriate ways to handle that. And, for example, not snapping girls' bras in fourth grade when there's one girl who wears a bra. We think that can be very traumatic. So we do want to support the boys so that they have the knowledge to react appropriately and treat their peers with kindness.
You do also advocating for using the technical anatomical terms for body parts, even with young children. Why is that important?
You know, we think it's important because we want to all be on the same page, particularly with our kids. And if we start to slip into euphemisms or kind of symbols but not use the real word, we don't know if we're talking about the same thing. I mean, a good example is for menstruation. Like, so many folks have historically used words like your visitor or Aunt Flo.
Or the curse,
my goodness. And it really makes more sense to be using the same words, and then they can use those words with their peers and kids can then make more sense out of it.
So any parting advice for, you know, people who are witnessing girls whose bodies are growing up much faster than their brains?
We really recommend treating them as their chronological age. There's such a push to think of them as more advanced or older or more mature if their bodies are developing early. And actually, they may not be socially, emotionally, and cognitively ready for those expectations.
Dr. Juliana Deerdorf right there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Juliana Deerdorf, clinical psychologist on the faculty of UC Berkeley. And Dr. Louise Greenspan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Louise Greenspan, a clinical pediatric endocrinologist. She also works at Kaiser San Francisco and is on the faculty at UC San Francisco. You can find much more on their book, The New Puberty. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Being in a band requires managing a number of close, sometimes tumultuous, relationships. Just one reason that a lot of artists decide to go solo, as they say. Julie Sabatier is host of Destination DIY, and today she brings us the story of a once famous rock star who now makes most of his music by himself in a very different genre.
I love working in radio. You just never know who you'll meet. A couple of years ago, I got a chance to conduct an interview on the radio variety show Livewire. It turns out that one of the other guests on this show was one of the very first musicians I ever saw play live.
My name is Chris Ballou. I'm the lead singer and songwriter for the Presidents of the United States of America professional rock band. I'm sad alone in a boggy marsh,
totally motionless except for her heart. That's right. I grew up in the 90s, and the Presidents were a pretty big deal. One of my first live rock and roll experiences was seeing them at a festival in Washington, D.C. These days, Chris Ballou isn't really focused on the Presidents. He's got another project going on.
I am also Casper Baby Pants, maker of music for children age 0 to 5. I'm an acorn small and round, lying on the cold, cold ground. Everyone walks over me. That is why I'm cracked, you see. I'm a nut. I'm a nut. I'm a nut. I'm a nut.
Chris had done the major label thing with his rock band, so when he started making kids' music, he decided to do it all himself. Not only is it a solo music project, he also runs his record label out of his house and distributes the music himself. I asked him what it's been like to go back to his DIY roots.
I get to use every color in my paint box, so to speak. I think of sound sometimes as colors, and a rock band is like a primary. It's like blue, yellow, and red. With maybe some purple. But working by myself, it's just every single color I can imagine. And anywhere my mind wants to go, it can go. If I want to put strings on a part for 2 seconds, I can. I don't have to explain it. If I want to erase the guitar completely and replace it with a, you know, weird little banjo or a rubber band or something, I can do it.
Birdie walked though she could fly. Bird bath puddle and the bird stays dry. Bird dragging off shaking fries. She got a wild look in her eye.
Are there any disadvantages to doing things by yourself when it comes to music?
Absolutely not. There are no disadvantages. I love it. I'd like to do both, you know. So I'm not a totalitarian about one way or the other is the answer. I mean, occasionally I love to hang out with Jason and Andrew, play a show, have that experience, but then I'm really happy to get back in my studio and put my mad scientist hat on and, you know, get back to work in the laboratory.
A dust mite is the smallest pet, but I don't care, it's all I could get. I saw its eyes through a microscope, they were filled with tears, they were filled with hope. Took her home and made her bed, but she would not lay down her tiny head. So I told her a tale of silly things, and she yawned and stretched and started to sing. I said, dust mites, just mites, not bite, if you treat her right. Dust mites, just mites, sleep tight, right through the night.
It's a total DIY operation. I run my label out of my laundry room and run my website myself through a company called Bandzoogle. They're really great. So yeah, I do it all myself, do all the accounting, the bookkeeping, the booking of shows, the, you know, advancing of shows. I come from a real rich DIY root system, basically. Years before I was successful, I realized that the chances of being successful in the, you know, common sense of the word, like, you know, financial reward and notoriety, I realized that that was probably not going to happen or might be a long shot. So I adjusted my sense of success to mean writing songs, recording songs, putting them on cassettes and giving them to people and playing shows. And I just decided, that's it. If I can do that, then I'm successful. And I really felt like that was enough. Way, I feel like I've come around full circle to this sensation of satisfaction that was similar to that late 80s vibe. You know, I'm back doing the same thing. And I'll tell you, the side trip I took into conventional success wasn't that awesome. And nobody wants to hear about how success is not that awesome, because then you sound like a complaining rock star. The truth is, everybody says it's going to be amazing and it's going to be perfect and you're going to have this wonderful time. But the fact is, you inherit a whole poop storm of new responsibilities and business, you know, models that you don't understand and ways to lose your money and people who can cheat you out of your money and stress about maintaining your current level of success and all this stuff that's just absolutely has nothing to do with songs, you know, and music. So I feel like music drives everything I do now. And the rest of, you know, it's the top of the, it's the prow of the ship, and the rest is just there to support it.
And that piece was produced by Julie Sabatier of Destination DIY. Word of Mouth actually conducted our own interview with Chris Ballou a couple of years ago. He's just released his 10th full-length album as Casper Baby Pants. You can check out that conversation at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Take the last train of Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30 because I've made your reservation.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Something happened to music in the mid-60s. In 1966, the Monkees rode Last Train to Clarksville to the top of the charts, landing alongside California Dreaming and Winchester Cathedral.
Winchester Cathedral, the armor ringing me down.
That same year, rock music aligned with the social changes sweeping the country and the availability of LSD, opening up a countercultural approach to reality and spirituality.
Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. It is not dying.
That's the Beatles' Tomorrow Never Knows. The Rolling Stones also hit it big that year with Paint It Black, representing the darker side of the spiritual rebellion that gave rock its initial power. From Robert Johnson's mythical deal with the devil to the coded messages in Led Zeppelin songs to the devilish imagery of heavy metal, the drive for the divine encounter rode shotgun with rock and roll, fueled by references to magic, arcane mysticism, Satan, the occult, and a lot of drugs. It also kept rock and roll from dissolving into the sugary waste of the pop charts. That's the theory put forth by author Peter Biebergall in a book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. I spoke with Peter when the book first came out. It is now out in paperback.
What's interesting about the Robert Johnson myth is it really wasn't Robert Johnson originally that even knew about that idea about himself. It was another Johnson who had perpetuated a myth of learning how to play the guitar by meeting the devil at the crossroads. But this idea of a devil at the crossroads really comes from a West African and Haiti religious traditions whereby there were these deities, Legba, Father Legba in particular, who was a crossroads deity. He acted as a mediator between heaven and earth, or the spirit world, as it were. And when this deity made its way across the ocean over to America, he was transformed into the devil, because any of these deities that Africans had brought with them to the United States were not going to fit well with the Christianity that was important for them to be absorbed into.
Well, decent, God-fearing people have been saying rock and roll is the devil's music since it first broke through to white America. And even before that, the same charge was made of the blues, largely helped along by the myth of Robert Johnson's deal with the devil. What did you find about the origins of this association?
Well, I think that the first thing that was scaring white people was when they would catch their slaves in the South, slave owners, doing their, what were called their hush harbor worship, which was a kind of Christian worship. They took to the story of salvation that was sort of forced onto them when they arrived in America, but they found their own way to worship using something in particular called the ring shout, which involved a very evocative and loud way of yelling out their worship of God. But that tradition of worship, that way of being religious, came with them from Africa. And so even though they were believing as Christians, they were worshiping as pagans, as their tribal past. And that was a very frightening thing for the white establishment to see. They saw that kind of rhythm. They heard that sounds of those drums as barbaric, as devilish, and they saw Christianity as something that could clean it out of them.
So later on, those traditions were carried into the black church. And there is the old trope about singing the blues on Saturday and then being in the pews on Sunday morning. The music essentially the same, the lyrics changed. You make the point that the blues actually offered some solutions that the church didn't.
That's right. And there's a wonderful variety of blues songs that speak very explicitly about using forms of voodoo or voodoon as a way to charm the woman that you love or try to make a little extra money. And so these obviously are practices that the church would not have approved of. But people don't always live their faith exactly as the church would have them. And so you have a tradition that was brought to the South coming from these different countries like Haiti and West Africa, and bringing along with them these traditions that involved what we would call occult practices. And that easily made its way into the music.
So there is a spiritual rebellion that rose along with what became rhythm and blues and rock and roll music. Here's an example. Here's the Isley Brothers Shout, parts 1 and 2, evoking the church and that uncut emotion that was feared by white America.
You know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout. Come on now, don't forget to say you will. Don't forget to say yeah, 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 yeah.
Say you will.
Say it right now, baby.
Say you will.
Come on, come on.
Say you will.
Say it better, yeah. Come on now.
Such an irony there that Elvis Presley, who brought black music to white America, was feared for his swiveling hips, which he said he learned where? In the Pentecostal church.
That's right. And there's a wonderful story of an early Pentecostal preacher who's trying to get his congregants to shout and to dance and to praise the Lord. And he says, "We can't let the devil keep all this good rhythm."
When you say that the occult saved rock and roll, we should clarify what you mean by occultism, which you define pretty broadly.
Very broadly. So really what I want to talk about and what I talk about in the book is the occult imagination. And the occult imagination includes both the ways in which people believe. People have always long believed in spirits and the spirit world and being able to communicate with them and being able to divine the future and being able to cast a spell. It was very part of really of early religion. People have also been afraid of those practices. People saw those in opposition to mainstream religions where you had somebody mediating those things for you. You shouldn't be on your own, left to your own devices to try to speak to spirits. There are priests and rabbis who take care of that business for you. So you have really this whole spectrum of the ways in which people both are afraid of it, believe in it, maybe don't believe in it at all, but are interested in the humor of it or how it can be used to sell an album by putting an upside down pentagram on the cover.
So it's less nefarious than kind of casting aside the convention, which is endemic to rock and roll. And so is, or was, sexuality. Now, where does that more decadent search for salvation come into this?
Well, I think sex is absolutely the essential way to spiritually rebel because sex is long used as an indicator of sin, of being on the side of the devil. And so when you have a sense of sexual freedom and you can somehow underpin that, say in the 60s, with a sense of spiritual freedom as well, well, now you've really charged it up.
So you point out that this is cynical in a sense, or let's say calculated, you know, a great way to sell an album. But there were genuine seekers there. And I want to talk
Absolutely.
About Jimmy Page and Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin. Here is some of that mythical imagery, in this case, Tolkien characters in the song Ramble On. This is from Led Zeppelin 2.
Just in the darkest depths of Mordor, I met a girl so fair. But Gollum at the evil wall crept up and slipped away with her, yeah. I did nothing happen to me.
On the early pressings of the album that followed were etched the words, "Do what thou wilt." Now, this is a core belief of the English occultist Aleister Crowley. Jimmy Page had a kind of Crowley fixation, but you point out that it wasn't satanic.
No, and there's long been the association that anything occult has to do with Satan. And I think sometimes occultists like Aleister Crowley at the time liked to continue that association because it gave him an aura of being dangerous, who had access to hidden knowledge. But we're really talking about somebody who saw the occult as a means of personal liberation, of personal freedom. And again, we can look all through back and look at artists and musicians, and we can see that this idea of artistic freedom was often tied with a spiritual freedom. And that often meant having to bump up against both the mainstream artistically and the mainstream religiously. So in the case of these young musicians at the time, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, doing something that was so unique and having access suddenly to a lot of money and things that they didn't have before allowed them to explore ideas that they maybe didn't necessarily have access to, or at least be able to dig a little bit deeper. And so I think it's very normal for somebody their age at the time to be interested in these kinds of things in the same way their fans were. But they could take it a little bit further because they had the means and they also had music, which was a way for them to express these ideas.
And they had an audience.
Yes, and they changed rock and roll.
We're talking with the author Peter Biebergall, who says that rock's essential rebellious spirit is a spiritual rebellion at its core. He's the author of a new book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. And he makes the case that all of the alternative and countercultural spiritualism that was brewing in mid-century America found a perfect vehicle in rock and roll and spread it to the masses. Well, how many kids slow dancing to Stairway to Heaven? You know, I remember that. Yeah, studying album covers and lyrics and looking for clues into meanings. But look at Charles Manson's claim that the White Album commanded him to murder, several murders in the 1960s. Couldn't teenagers or anyone with enough time divine whatever meaning they wanted from this music, occultist or not?
Absolutely. And that's kind of the danger, I guess, of any kind of magical thinking and really in any kind of religious or spiritual idea. I mean, the thing about we go to great lengths to try to separate occult thought from what we might call traditional religious thought. But really, some of the same psychological activities are at play, which is accepting the idea of some transcendent reality, accepting the idea that somehow human beings can have some interaction with the divine. And so whether you are a Christian fundamentalist or whether you are a believer in the occult, you could spend time looking for symbols and trying to extract meaning. What's amazing about rock and roll was that what we might call the occult imagination found a perfect vehicle in this music to express itself.
Well, I think of Mick Jagger, you know, prancing around with the sort of persona of the devil and singing Sympathy for the Devil, a song more about the chaos of the 60s. But for him, it was about the power over audiences that it conferred. And likewise, you know, you write about Black Sabbath later admitting that their darkness was calculated, social and spiritual defiance for working class boys. Now, wasn't that also true of listeners and fans, you know, glomming onto some kind of mystery that might distinguish them from their family or their peers?
That's right. And we do that all the time. I mean, let's take a moment where we go to see a magic show. I mean, we live in, you know, it's 2014, and anybody who goes to see a magician, even on the street or in a theater, knows that there's a trick, knows that it's not real magic. And yet we go into those situations allowing ourselves to be hypnotized by that. We want to be enchanted. And the same with the fans and their music. There's, I think, the very same transmission that's going on between the magician and the audience, the musician and the audience, and maybe even in ancient religious traditions, the shaman and the tribe.
Now Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the spiders from Mars. He played it left but made it too far. Became the special man. Then we were Ziggers.
You write also about David Bowie's obsession with aliens, you know, Yes's album covers, prog rock, Hotel California, Jay-Z playing with Illuminati symbols, and goths. When did this all stop, Peter?
I don't think it's actually stopped. I do think there's a new generation of musicians who are seeing what can actually be really fun about these ideas. That maybe, you know, we're not living in a time where, like in the 70s, where you could go buy your ESP testing cards in the bookstores. But there's certainly a whole new generation that is in love with horror movies, that's in love with comic books, that wants to play Dungeons and Dragons, that still is interested in the fantastic and the fantastical. And even though science sort of dominates our understanding of the world, that there's still a way that we can let this imagination have its place in our pop culture. And there's many musicians that are still seeing that, you know what, there's something really interesting about the way these images and these ideas can be presented and can actually enhance the experience of listening to this music.
Anyone you can think of that's doing it particularly well?
Well, there's a really great underground movement, although the underground today really doesn't function in the same way. There's a band called Sun. And the lead is
S-U-N or S-O-N?
Well, they spell it S-U-N, and then there's a O with a bunch of closed parentheses. and they model it after actually an amplifier company named Sun, and that was their logo. And the lead of that, or really the creative force behind it, is a fellow named Stephen O'Malley. And what he's doing is he stages Sun concerts where they literally wear robes and have fog machines. And he uses the language of heavy metal, but is really producing some incredible, almost orchestral kind of rock and roll with down-tuned guitars and deep, heavy sounds that... Going to one of their concerts, it's so loud that you can actually feel it vibrating in your chest. And I think he really sees that there's a way of mixing these ideas, these images, and this music, something that maybe is a little bit sinister sounding, and it can actually transport you.
So, Peter, were the preachers right all along? Is rock and roll really the devil's music?
It certainly is.
Peter Biebergall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Biebergall is author of three books, most recently Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. You'll find more, including some reviews of the book, at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a ubiquitous piece of rhetorical style that you may have heard but never heard of. We'll learn about asterismos when Word of Mouth continues. Let me please introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. I lay traps for troubadours who get killed before they reach my face. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. So, well, look, if you're used to starting sentences like that, you are not alone. These words, properly called asterismos, can be found everywhere, from boardrooms in Silicon Valley, to rappers, to podcasts, to presidential speeches.
So that's why these letters are so important to me.
So in July, We started working with Airtel.
So, like, I seem to be getting along with you.
Now, throughout history, India has always been...
So, while we have fought back from the worst of this recession...
NPR counted President Obama using now and so to begin 7 out of 11 paragraphs in one speech in 2010, making him a champion of extraneous words. So what's the story behind these words we say before we say what we really mean? Katie Waldman is Slate's word correspondent who wrote about asterismos. And Katie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I think I get it, but can you define asterismos for us?
Sure. So these are, as you said, the types of extraneous words that you use to set up a statement. So if I say, right, okay, look, here is the definition of asterismos. Those would be examples of the device. And it goes back very far. You can see it in Beowulf. Lots of ancient epic poetry starts that way, just to sort of establish that a new thing is beginning and to get everyone to pay attention. And as you said, it's all over the place now in formal oratory and in, you know, pop culture.
Those old stories like, behold, that kind of thing.
Yep, exactly.
So there's a little bit of a listen up quality to asterismos.
Mm-hmm.
People in authority tend to use them. We mentioned Barack Obama and Silicon Valley stars. Mark Zuckerberg is full of them. Now, what about these words lend gravitas or importance?
Well, I think part of it is that they announce that something new is beginning, and they don't communicate meaning so much as they sort of signal that someone is about to say something, and there's kind of an authority to being able to clear the air and focus everyone. And then I think when you say, so, that's why we're doing this, it situates the statement in kind of a chain of causality, and it implies that you have reasons for saying what you're going to say.
Mm-hmm. So you've really thought this through.
Right.
In your article, you write that extraneous words are a luxury for those who don't need to prove their right to speak. What about all these other articles that we've seen recently claiming women need to be more straightforward with the way that we speak in particular? You know, not using words like or totally that somehow detract from meaning.
I think that's a really interesting point. There is a way in which asterismos communicates insecurity because there's a kind of hedging quality if you say, okay, well, so, you know, as if you're trying to postpone saying what you actually want to say. On the other hand, I think that this particular device also communicates power and sort of your own confidence in what you're about to say because you're telling other people, listen, I've got something that you should pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. So okay can begin a strong statement, whereas okay is a little more cringeworthy as a question. Well, NPR hosts and reporters are apparently notorious for using asterismos. Any theories on as to why?
Well, I think that something that's kind of peculiar about this device is it has that air of authority, but it's also quite casual. You know, the word okay, so, now, they're all colloquial terms that you hear in everyday conversation. And so I think it sort of goes with the aura that you get around NPR. These are friendly, casual, smarty pantses who are going to enlighten you but not be obnoxious while they do so. And so I think actually it's a perfect fit.
So, Katie, thanks.
Thank you.
Katie Waldman, she's Slate's words correspondent. She wrote the article, Listen. So what are these words we say before we say what we mean to say? You can find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow, too, with more Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.